My sobriety date is July 20th of 2007. Apparently, if you're looking for anger management, you would need to go somewhere else. That's not what we're doing here. I created a process, and it was actually a liberated thing, so I'll give some credit to somebody in a minute for the liberation of that on anger resolution. And so I got sober, and the thing is, if you had asked certain people when they met me when I got sober, is he an angry guy? Well, he probably would have said this, yes, because I presented volatile and defensive and hypersensitive. I mean, I presented just like on people all the time. The reality, though, is if you ask guys that had been around a long time, what they would have told you was that's a fragile, fearful kid in a grown man's body. And that was probably more accurate. I just was so broken by the time I got here and needed to front. There was a front to what I did because I needed to keep people at bay. I just felt like it was better for me to protect myself to keep y'all at bay. So when I was about 3.5 years sober or so, I got engaged. And, you know, we you know, just kind of the sober engagement thing. I don't know how many people have done that, but it looked a lot different than the drinking marriage. But it kind of, as we went through getting closer to marriage, her mom became sicker and sicker and sicker. She had a lot of emotional issues, and man, she stopped showing up. You know, my wife's father had been deceased a long time, so this is the only parent she had that would show up for her daughter, and what I thought she should do anyways. And she just wouldn't show up. So we were like the, you know, whatever parties they throw for the bride-to-be, her mom wouldn't be there. And I started to become unraveled, quite honestly, and really, really judgmental. And we went to get a venue together, and her mom went with us. And, you know, we kind of picked out our venue, and her mom was pretty overbearing and said, no, we're going to do this other venue, which was exponentially more money than I could spend, and she said she would pay for it. And when it came time to pay, she ghosted us. So we ended up paying it out of pocket. And so as these things started to happen, I became more and more enraged. And I never went to her and told her how I felt about her, because it was my wife's mom. But I started to unravel. About maybe 8 days or so, 10 days before we were to get married, I remember, I'll probably never forget this, I was on the phone with my sponsor and told him it would be easier if she was dead. This would be a much easier process for me at this point if she was dead. And 3 days before we were going to get married, we went to check on her, and she'd hung herself 8 days before. And what I had said stuck to me, and I could not shake it. And we went and got married on the 16th of June in 2012. And on July the 20th, I picked up a 5-year medallion. And on August 20th, I was headed to a liquor store. Now, I just could not be okay with what had happened or the pain that I felt. And most of the people that, if they had seen that from the outside at that time, would have said, he is justified to be angry. He is justified to feel whatever he feels about her. It's, you know, she is to blame. But what people didn't see was that 6 months earlier, I wasn't going to as many meetings. And I wasn't talking to a sponsor. And I wasn't talking to sponsees. And I wasn't praying. I was all invested in this marriage. I wasn't prepared on any level for what was going to happen. So I became unglued. And the day that I went to drink, I kind of was on autopilot. I ended up on 400 North back when it was a toll road. That was the only thing that really saved me, quite honestly. And I was sitting at a toll with no money, crying, and I couldn't get it together. And for the second time, the hand of AA reached out to me. Someone called me and said, what's going on with you? And they came down and picked me up. And that night, I reached out to my sponsor. He had me call Bill Sanders, and Bill had me call a guy named Bob M., who, if you've ever been to Napa, you would know who I'm talking about. Bob had saw me the next day. He had created, I guess, over 20 or 25 years in AA, he had created this anger work. And it was one piece of paper. It was a front and back. That was all that there was. And we went through that, and we went through some grief work. And maybe about 18 months after this, here at one of these workshops, I sat down with my sponsor and did some amends with her. And what had registered with me over that time was that I was really angry, but I'm not sure why. You know, what she had done was could be viewed as selfish, but the reality is she's a human being. And she was having human reactions to human problems. And I couldn't see it like that on any level whatsoever. Now, I've been a guy that has done some anger management before, not necessarily because I wanted to do anger management, but someone had decided that I needed to do that. That might be something that y'all can relate to. And what anger management did for me is gave me a skill set that I could use, but I never knew what the problem was. So it was like putting a Band-Aid on a severed arm. And I could put it on briefly, and then I would unravel. And I could put it on, and you would piss me off, and I would unravel. And I never understood why that was happening. So, you know, a couple years after this, I started to really investigate that. It became something that was became almost a passion for me. I wanted to know why it was that when I felt defensive, I reacted. And it was instant. There was no thought to it. You know, kind of what I'd learned, and, you know, I'm a therapist, so I had to learn some of this stuff. Reaction is reptilian. That's the first part of the brain developed. You know, rattlesnakes don't typically think things through. You get in front of them, and they react, and it's instant. Response is frontal cortex. That's the last part of the brain developed, right? That's the ability to rationally think things through. But the reality is when I get angry, I don't, like, stop and think, you know, why am I really angry here? No, I mean, I just react, and it's instant. And that's caused a lot of problems for me in the past. So I started to really look at that stuff. And so with Bob's blessing, I guess, because I called before I started doing any work with it, I created a process. And it's a process I use in my private practice. But, you know, what had started out as this lengthy thing that I thought that I had needed to take people through this long journey to figure out what the hell was going on. I've shortened down to like 5 sessions. You know, there's no reason to just come see me for a year. I know I don't want to see you for a year, so imagine you don't want to see me for a year. But one of the things that came from that was, and I'm an analogy-based guy, so if you don't like analogies, you're probably screwed here. One of the things that came out of that, the first thing that I do with people is looking at the house. Like looking at yourself as a house. Now, I don't know how many people here live in the suburbs, but if you do, most suburban homes now have a really nice yard. Like, that thing is pristine, man. It's crazy. So you're looking, if let's say Bill decided, insanely I might add, to have all of us here come to his house and stand on the curb and look at his house, what do we see? Well, we would see a mowed yard, trimmed hedges and bushes, nice pretty flowers, a front door. We're going to say it's a brick house. I've only been to Bill's a couple times. You know, windows and a door and a roof. And, you know, it's a house. It's not like a trap house. It's an actual house in the suburbs. And that's what we see, that because that's what's being presented to us to see. And if he invited us inside, into the foyer, we see floors and walls and ceilings and, you know, drywall and things like that. And it's houses usually are just stuffed full of furniture and just amazing amounts of furniture that we collect over time and fill a house with. And if he were to allow us to, and I can't imagine he would, but he might, you know, well, we could ask to take all that furniture out and pull all that drywall off and the ceiling and rip the flooring out, all of that comes out of the house, what we're left with is the framework of the home. Framework being where the guts of this building are located behind. You know, the wiring and the plumbing, all that's behind the drywall typically. And then if we bulldozed it down, we'd have a foundation. Now, if you look at yourself as an alcoholic, what's the foundation that most of us have? And these are things that happen way young. This is like what you're born with, kind of, if you're an alcoholic. Foundation, I found out for most people I know, including myself, is self-centered fear. From an early age, driven by this overwhelming fear. But it was never like a fear of, oh my God, how's this going to affect you? I don't really care how it affects you. It's, how is this going to affect me? And as I start building the framework around that foundation as a child, this is years before I drink, there are some things that I found that are generally the same among most of the people I've ever worked with, certainly with myself. One of the things that my framework has in it is insecurity. An absolutely overwhelming sense that I need to fit in at all costs. And a suspicion that I don't, no matter what I do. No matter what I do, I can't quite live up to whatever the expectations I have for myself or other people I feel have for me. There's always this need to fit in, to feel like I'm connected to you, that you believe in me, that we're friends. And if I look at my history, there are times where I'm like making straight A's in school, I'm doing music, I'm doing sport, I'm doing all the things that people expected me to do, but I still don't feel like I measure up. I mean, I hear that a lot from the podium in different places where I listen to speakers. There's a kind of common theme or trend among most of the speakers that we ever hear, and they say, I just didn't feel like I measured up. Like, I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't put a finger on what it was. The other thing that I have is, and I don't know as an alcoholic if you can relate to this, but I have this crazy mind. Crazy mind. And my mind says to me that I know what he's thinking, although we've never had a conversation. Like, I'm not going to approach him and ask him what he's thinking, but I'm convinced as I'm, oh, see, his hand was up, now it's down. I'm convinced I know what that means. I know exactly what he's thinking about me. He thinks this talk sucks. Hate that guy. You know what I mean? I mean, it is instant. And what I do with that, because you have this insecurity and I need for you to like me and I need for you to enjoy this talk and all these things are going on in my mind, I start to chess match what I think you're going to say. Or what I think you're going to do next. So I've got four or five scenarios laid out now, all up here, no conversation, so that regardless of what you do, I'm ready. And then I'm ready. And I'm doing this not with one person. I'm doing this with every single human being I come in contact with. Now, I do this now. I guarantee you I did this as a child because I needed to fit in. So every person that I have any kind of relationship with, hand on the mouth, staring at this picture up here. I know what that means. I'm ready. Okay. And we're setting it all up. It's like a guy that's, you ever seen those people spinning plates? Oh my God, dude, really? I mean, that's what most of us typically do. We're like dancing with plates. It's insane. I'm also hypersensitive, which creates another set of issues. So I'm terribly insecure. I'm driven by fear. My mind tells me I know what he's thinking about me at all times. Typically, it's never good. Now, if he were a female, it would be amazing. Whatever the hell he was thinking would be amazing about me. But as a dude, he's thinking something bad. And I'm hypersensitive. So not only do I believe I know what you're thinking about me. Yeah, I see that. Yep. And now I'm preparing a reaction. Does that make sense? Like, there's this overwhelming sense that I know what he's thinking and I'm ready to pounce on it. And I'm also terribly defensive. So it's the combination that I'm living with. Hypersensitive, insecure, defensive. This is my wheelhouse. This is the frame of my home. And I have one more piece that's added in. There's this shame. Now, what I've realized over time is if I steal money out of my mom's purse, that it is likely at some point later I will feel ashamed of that behavior. Because that's situationally based. You know, I did something, an action, I feel ashamed about the action. That's not what I'm talking about. Most of the people I've ever met in these rooms have shame. Now, if you'd asked me 10 years ago what that meant, I would have said, well, you would have to have been sexually molested or raped or physically abused or killed somebody. That's shameful. But the reality is, if I have a mind that tells me I know what you're thinking about me, then it can be a whole lot less than that. A whole lot less than that. And shame being for me, and I'm going to paraphrase this, I wish I'd written it down, but Brené Brown has a definition. She talks about this feeling of worthlessness, that I just don't measure up, that I never fit in. Now that's the framework of my home as a child, that I'm always trying to just hope that you love me. Part of that for me, and again, I'm an analogy guy. If you have a 5-year-old little girl out here, and we bake some fresh hot cookies, and we bring them out in front of said little girl, and she takes 5 and puts in her lap, and her mother, without meaning any malice, looks at her and says, "You don't have to be so selfish." And that little girl has the head and heart that I have. That's an identity, and it's an instant identity. And for the rest of her life, what you're going to see from that little girl is she going to prove one or two things. Oh, you think I'm selfish? Watch this. Or she's going to people please every single person in her life. Every person she comes in contact with, you've got to like me, 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 and I'll do whatever it takes for that to happen. And that's based out of one comment, one time. How many comments did I hear as a kid that could have been identities for me? How many people in here play sports? Because that seems to be typically what a lot of men do when they're growing up. You know, I got a coach and he's, you know, raising his voice to 10 guys on the team. And I don't know what they do, the 9 guys that go home. But I go home with a sense that I absolutely have to be perfect. Have to be perfect. There's not like a gray area in that. It has to happen. And I'll work harder and play harder and train harder, and there's going to come a point for me, and it may or may not come for you, where I know that no matter what I do, I'm not going to be good enough. So I'm just going to quit. And I just throw in the towel on. And I know from my history with like athletics, that happened more than one time. Now, when I look back at that retrospectively as a grown man, I don't know if that coach actually said to me, "You need to be perfect." I may have just internalized that because, again, I hear things that aren't being said. I believe things from this head that aren't actually in play. So I've got fear-driven. My framework is shame. Now, and again, with shame, and a lot of us, I know I do, have an abuse history, right? Now, if I have this other stuff going on, and there is any rape or molestation or anything like that, physical violence in my house, that's like a thumb pressing that down in. That's cementing that identity for me. And as I get older, anything that's similar to that cements that in. Time after time after time after time. So I'm convinced that I'm worthless. You know why? Because when they touched me the way they did that because they knew I was worthless. And I'm not talking to people about that as a kid, but that is definitely what's going on inside. Shame, insecurity, hypersensitive, defensiveness. What option do I really have at that point? When I put that drywall up around that framework, I'm putting it up thick, and when I fill that house with furniture, I'm filling it with as much furniture as I can get in it. Because every part of my being has to keep you at bay at all times. I can't have anyone get close to me on any level at that point. Isn't that one of the things that you hear oftentimes by the time people get to Alcoholics Anonymous? I disconnected from life. I disconnected from my family, from my wife, from my husband, from people around me. I grew apart from them. Why? For me, because I'm absolutely terrified to let you get close to me. Not because I'm a criminal or an alcoholic, but because from an early age, I've known that I was worthless, that I would never measure up. And I can't have you know that about me. Because this mind says, if you know that, you're going to use it against me. The next piece of that house, then, is to protect. Now, most of us, certainly the guys in this room, most of the people I've ever come in contact with in these rooms, had a skill set in place before they ever drank. There was a skill set that you guys were actually like honed in on like at an early age. And typically it's the same skill set. I was incredibly good at manipulation and dishonesty. This is way long time before I drank. I knew how to play parents against each other, teacher against each other. As someone that's driven by a high level of insecurity, I don't have an option, right? I have to kind of lie to you because you've got to like me. You like me? Okay, you're good. Now I'm doing you over here. You like me? Good. Okay, we're going over there. And it's constant building the web and getting good at it, real good at it. For anyone in here that has an abuse history, you know how to dissociate. There's no question about it. Anybody in here a criminal? Don't raise your hands. If you are, you know how to dissociate. I guarantee it. Dissociation meaning that I can be on autopilot in a situation where I should be emotionally affected by it. But I'm not on any level. I'm building that skill set as a kid because I have to. I don't have an option. And I can detach. I can take myself mentally out of a situation and then drive on autopilot while I'm in it. This is a skill set that I built as a kid so that when I go into drinking, it's a seamless transition. It's crazy if you look at it, really, for most of us. It's seamless. Like, I remember people in my life that kind of made that transition with me, the Boone's Farm transition, you know what I mean? The wine that's not wine transition. And I would look at some of them and be like, I can't believe he got caught. Why were you honest? Why did you tell people you did this? You know? For me, it was like a seamless transition into daily drinking and criminal behavior. And it was instant. Why? Well, hell, I've been working, honing a skill set for years before then that was going to make it a seamless transition. And the last piece of that house is that suburban home, right? With that really nice manicured lawn, the lawn service that comes in every 2 weeks and blows the yard off. And, you know, I don't know how many people here own a home. I do. It's shocking to me, quite honestly. And if you knew my history, you would think the same. But the last thing I want to do in July when I work all day is go home and make my yard look good. That for me, that's just not important. But I typically do that, and people in suburban America do it all the time. Do I do that because I really want my yard to look good? Or I do that because I want you to think my yard's going to look good? See, I have this history of a guy that wants to present a picture that may not be real. Right? What am I doing? Protecting myself at all costs from everyone around me. So I have to have a yard that looks great. So what I was taught as a man, like as a kid, everybody comes from different places and we taught different things, but what I'm taught is, as a man, you never show emotion. You can get angry, you might can get happy, but typically, don't ever let them know what you're thinking or what you're feeling. Also, men, ride in on their white horse and save the day. Right? So when you look at that situation with my wife or her mother committed suicide and I unravel after that, am I really unraveling after that because I'm so affected by that suicide? Or am I unraveling after that because as a man, I can't save her from that pain? That's my wife. I can't take that pain away from her. But every part of my being, from what I was raised with, says that I should. That as a man, that's my job. So I'm trying to control my wife's grief process for a year and unraveling on the inside as a human being behind it. What ends up happening for me, it may or may not be this way for you, with my anger being a reaction, is one of two things. Both of them are created to keep people at a distance. Either I am completely volatile reactive. Right? I'm a yelling, what do they call them now? Terroristic threats? Thank God they haven't always called them that. You know, I'm a scream yell guy. If I scream loud enough, you'll back off. If I threaten your family, I'm hoping you'll back off. You know what I mean? Or, and I bet there are a whole bunch of people in here that maybe will be doing this right now. I'm a murder plot guy. you know, oh, I know, see this guy right here? He's a murder plot guy. See how he's looking right now? He's just smiling, shaking his head. I hear you, buddy. You're disrespecting me? That's okay. It's not a problem. I'm going to kill that guy in 3 years. You know what I mean? I'm like fixated on this fantasy for days and days and days and days, and I never let go of it. There's a story in the back of the big book. I think it's called To Handle Sobriety, and he talks about that. He talks about being fixated on, if that ever happens again, I'm going to do this. If they ever talk to me like that again, this is how I'm going to respond. He can't let go of it. And people that have the anger I have, they can't let go of it. And the reality is, there have been times in my life where if we sat down and talked about the things that made me mad when I was 10, I would have given you detail like it just happened. You would have seen me get heated like it had just happened. I'm talking stuff that happened 30, 35, for some of you guys, 40 years ago. How is that letting go? The reality is, I don't know how to let go. That's part of the problem. So I have this either mind that says that if I scream at you enough, you'll back off. And if that doesn't happen, I'll kill you with my head. And I won't let go of it. Somehow that is going to affect you. And those two things funnel into the same place for me personally. They funnel into this thing that goes on at night. It goes on a lot in early recovery for most of us. There's this voice inside my head. Right? And the things that it tells me, it's told me since I was a kid. You're worthless. Why do you even try? You're never going to get better anyways. Because I can yell and scream about her all I want to do. And I cannot let go of that anger toward them. But I'm by myself in my head alone when I go to sleep. And that voice gets real loud. And that time period for me between June 13th and August 20th of 2012, when I almost drank again, that voice got real loud. Deafening loud. You're a worthless human being. You can't protect your wife. What are they going to think about you? Those people when you were a child, they were right about you. Those people that hurt you as a child, there's a reason they did that. That voice got so loud, I couldn't handle it. And I was headed to a liquor store behind it. It's an interesting thing how many people I see like myself. I came in and out of this program for a long, long stretch of time. And there were times that I did the work. I mean, I did stuff in AA. It wasn't like I just went to meetings occasionally. I did work. But one of the things that never changed for me, and one of the reasons I believe that I went back to drinking, is that I was convinced I wasn't worth it. I wasn't worth sobriety. And when that voice gets real loud, what do I really have to put up against it? You know? The process that I created is not for y'all to forgive other people. If you were in 12-step recovery at some point, you'll be pressed by somebody to do that. It won't be me. This process created for people to forgive themselves. See, I don't want ice in the whiskey or cut on the dope. Why would I just want a little bit of forgiveness or a little bit of freedom? I mean, I can't speak for y'all, but I want the whole bag, man. I want as much freedom as I can get. And for me, forgiving other people is a start, but if I can't forgive myself, I don't get free. And if I don't get free, I will absolutely drink or use again. That for me is a guarantee. At some point, that'll happen. So this is about how do I get to a place where I can forgive myself. That house analogy is kind of the first piece of that. You know, I think it was important for me to get a real clear picture of why I carry the anger I carry and why I react the way I do. And my experience with anger management was they taught me these coping skills, but no one ever said, "Hey man, do you hate yourself?" Yeah. Why? That was never discussed. So that's part of what the house analogy does, is it breaks down for people what is really going on for most of us. Maybe not all of us, but certainly most of us have. There's a common theme that runs through the whole crowd. with that kind of stuff. So one of the assignments I give early on for people is for them to write down in detail the three earliest recollections they have with being hurt, emotionally hurt, or being angry, being afraid. I mean, stuff that's like significant, because if I remember it, to me it was significant. Doesn't mean it was significant for anybody else. But it's stuff that I remember. That means years later I'm still carrying that. And it's in me and it drives behavior. So, and the other thing I have people list, and I'll explain this further, is I have them list what they gained. Remembering gains are not positive or negative. Gains aren't like that. What they lost, again, not positive and negative, and how fear is connected to that. Because remember, fear for most of us is connected all the time. So, pick out an example. Let's say your 5-year-old little boy, you left your bike in the driveway, your dad comes home, screeching tires, pissed off, comes in the house, starts screaming. Voices raise instantly, he's fighting with your mom. Maybe he hits her. And what is the gain from that? Well, the gain from that for most of us is actually quite significant. I'm going to learn how to dissociate in that moment. Every time when I look at, from that point moving forward, someone gets aggressive with me and raises their voice and disrespects me, what is my instant reaction? It's to back you off at all costs. Something I can do, either mimicking what I learned as a kid or dissociating from it completely so that I'm on autopilot in that situation because it's too frightening to me. It reminds me of that over there, stuff I never really dealt with. What else do I gain? I gain the ability to lie. You're going to go to, if you get hit by your dad, you're going to go to school and tell people that when you're 5? You got this thing called defects. They'll show up at your house if you do that. So I'm going to learn how to lie to you as a peer. I'm going to learn how to lie to that teacher. I'm going to learn to lie to other parents. I'm learning that at 5. I'm learning how to manipulate at 5. I'm learning how to protect myself and my family at 5. You know what? I mean, this is just a made-up situation, but a lot of the people in this room have similar stuff in their history. You know, I'm learning a skill set at 5 years old. How much of that is in play before I start drinking? How much worse does it get when I'm drinking? How much of it is in play when I quit drinking? What do I lose? I lose respect for authority. I bet there's some people in here that know that real well. Just absolute no respect for authority at all. Why? My dad is an authority figure. Why would I respect you? You're yelling at me and my mom. You just hit my mom. Why can't you stand up for us? I'm losing it on both sides. I'm losing the ability to connect with people in a real way. I can't be authentic with you. I'm too afraid. I try to be authentic with you. You disrespect me. Done. And I'm convinced it's my fault. It's crazy. Neither of these are positive or negative things. This is just what I'm gaining and losing as a child. How is fear connected? For most of us, fear is connected when we're young kids because I think I'm going to be hurt real bad or killed or there's some significant thing. What does that fear look like, let's say, a year before you quit drinking? For me, it looked like, oh my God, I'm becoming them. It's part of the reason I drove me into recovery. I was becoming the people that I hated the most. It's like I was sinking in quicksand. And I had someone there in front of me with their hand out trying to pull me out of it. And I kept fighting and sinking and fighting and sinking and fighting and sinking. So that's part of the process that I work with people. You get a real clear picture of what you're working with, and then you get a real clear picture of the behavior that shows up today when you're angry. That stuff is stuff that you learned a long time ago. Most kids mimic what they see. Anybody here have children? They know exactly what I'm talking about. My little girl, she mimics what she sees from us. She doesn't necessarily follow what we say. She's 3. I need you to go to the potty. She goes to the potty right there. You know, I'm like, no, I meant the potty, like the actual potty. I need to go to the potty. But if we go to the potty with her and sit down, she'll learn, hey, go. You mean go to the potty? Sweet. Solid play. You know, I mean, that's one example. But as a child, I mimicked what I saw. And I have this crazy mind and this insecurity and all this fear. And all that's in play as I mimic what I see. So later in life, when I feel disrespected by you, see right there how he looked away and he looked back at me? Remember, I got that mind that says, I know what that means. No conversation necessary. What was that you said? You know, and you're up on somebody really quickly. That's crazy. Crazy, but a lot of us have that. They go on all the time. So what do you do with all that stuff? There's a concept that, you know, me and some people I work with came up with, and Bob helped create some of this. If you look at, let's say we all go to the beach. Anybody ever not been to the beach? I mean, most of you have been to the beach. You live in Georgia. And there's, like, let's say there's, we're standing in that, like, tall grass area, and the ocean's over there, and the beach is as far as we can see in both directions. That's a lot of sand. So a significant amount of sand. And I take one little handful of sand out and look at all that sand. I've got like, 5,000 granules of sand in my hand on a beach that stretches as far as I can see. And I put all those granules of sand on little pieces of glass and put them under a microscope. And what I'm going to find out real quickly, kind of amazing to me, is that those pieces of sand are molecularly different. Each one of them is an individual granule of sand. That's crazy to me. That's like a lot of individual granules of sand. Like everyone in this room is an individual. And the way that you look at yourself and look at the world around you and deal with the people around you, no one else in the world is going to do it like you do it. They're not going to think the way you think. They're not going to feel the way you feel. They're not going to perceive the way you perceive. Every one of us is absolutely different in that, and we could be looking or engaged in the same exact situation. We're all going to walk away with something just a little different. But all of us are here at AA retreat. So there's something that's common. We're all humans. Most of us would admit to being all alcoholics. We all know that we have some similar behavior. Like the granules of sand on the beach, all different from one another, they absolutely have to have each other, right? There has to be some connection and movement, some flow for them to stay, well, as a beach. There's something to that. When I get really angry, well, it doesn't even have to be really, when I get angry at all, one of the things that happens instantly for me is I absolutely disconnect from every other person in this room, and I have nothing in common with any of you instantly. My anger is mine, and if you were in my situation, you have that anger too. But the reality is, there's a lot of people in this workshop. I would assume that most of us have similar anger and similar traits. You know, there's something to that, like, connection piece that, well, people talk about in AA all the time. There were five questions that Bob gave me to help me calm down, right? And that's part of the anger work. And I got to be honest with you, I don't really like them. They're not questions that I want to ask myself when I get angry. A couple of them are okay, but then I'm like, I don't know, I'm done. I'm done with all this. I don't want to do this anymore. One of the first questions Bob asked me when I started working with him was, is this about relief or recovery? Like, when I get that angry about that thing, which is the biggest thing in the universe in that moment, am I engaged in relief or recovery? Most of the time, for me, I can't speak for y'all, in that moment, see, I get a feeling from that anger, right? When my blood starts to boil, I feel powerful and in control. I get high off of that. Well, that for me is about relief. Not at all about recovery. On any level whatsoever. So that's a question that I personally have to ask myself in that moment. Second question is, how free do I really want to be? I mean, do I want to be free? I'm claiming that in meetings. I'm claiming that with a sponsor. I'm claiming that with a wife. I'm claiming that in my prayer life. Get me angry. Let's see how free I really want to be. Because I don't know about you, but again, I get high off that anger. Even if it's not volatile, screaming, yelling anger, I still get high off of it. You know why? Because I'm controlling you with my mind from way over here. I'm going to kill you in a couple of years. More powerful than you. Ha ha ha. You know, there's that that goes on with me. It may not go on with you, but it goes on me, unfortunately, a lot. Would I rather be right or happy? Would I rather be right or happy? Well, I'm going to tell you I'd rather be happy, but I also want to be right. And there's a problem with that. There may not be for you, but there is for me, because as an alcoholic, I can't do both at the same time when I get angry. I'm either going to be right, and I'm going to suffer, and everyone around me is going to suffer behind it. Or I want to be happy, which means I'm going to let it go. Because how important is it really? And it may be in that moment the most important thing in the world, but for me, every moment is the most important in the world because I'm a self-driven alcoholic. This moment right now, for me, most important in the world. Don't care how you're affected on any level. Get me angry. That's amplified. 100 times over. So hopefully at the end of the day, I'd rather be happy. Because if I choose to be right long enough, I'll drink again. And it won't matter. Because then, you know what will happen then? You'll be right. That's a guarantee. You know, another question that was asking me was, what would you do if you were not afraid? Which unfortunately is an A and B question. B would be, what are you afraid of? You know, the reality is I'm a fear-driven individual. I'm fear-driven right now with 10 years sober as much as I was with one day sober. The fear now is different. It's different fear, but it's still fear. You know, what am I so afraid of? Why can't I just have a conversation with you? Why can't I just calm down enough to do that? Again, I have I have a mind that tells me I know exactly what he's thinking right now. See that look? You see his foot's moving? I know what that means. And I'm ready. I'm ready to... What was that? Oh. Okay. As I'm becoming right. And the last question that Bob asked me, and this is, for me, the absolute worst question that I have to ask myself is, how age-appropriate is your response? Yeah, nobody likes that, did they? Apparently, people just generally speaking don't like that. I have a 3.5-year-old little girl. What happens typically when we say, you got to put that down. Throws herself in the floor. Ah! Worst thing that ever happened in that moment for her. Until she sees something else. She's like, oh, look at that over there. You know? How similar am I? Right? When I get angry, how similar am I to that little girl? What do I really do? Oh, see, he did it again. He's rubbing his chin. Ah! It's like an instant reaction. It's crazy to me. So one of the things that, you know, I found to be helpful, and part of this is, you know, part of it's a trauma therapy that I do with people, and then there's the questions. But basically is being able to get right-sized in that moment as quickly as I can and using whatever strategy or skill that I have to make that happen. Now, I do a trauma therapy called rapid resolution with people that helps to ground them in that. But there are lots of things that you guys have access to outside of my wheelhouse that would get you right-sized instantly. And that's the important thing about this. Why do I have unresolved anger? Well, I have a childhood that I have a crazy head and I'm driven by all these different things. And I don't ever really look at it. I just avoid it at all costs. And it just kind of carries over with me in recovery. And I see it show up in every relationship that I have. If you make me mad, it's right back there and it's instant. But you know what? If I can get right-sized in that moment, like in that moment, like reach out to somebody that I know. I have a sponsor that helps me get right-sized pretty quickly. Hate him for that sometimes. But all of a sudden I start to see things, well, with different eyes. That seems to be helpful for most of us. See, my eyes are real blurry and confused. I'm a plate spinner, quite honestly, and I like to kill people with my head. You know, we're in the grocery store and he's looking at me. That guy, I hate that guy, I hope that guy dies. You know, I mean, it's that thing that goes on because I feel disrespected somehow, or it's this huge thing that's happened, or no one understands my pain. You know, when my mother-in-law committed suicide, no one understood my pain. No one's ever been through that in recovery, ever. Grief and loss. Getting right-sized in that moment is realizing that I may not be the only one out there that suffered grief and loss as a human being. Seems like kind of a common theme that everyone's going to suffer. And I may not be the only guy that was ever molested. And that seems to be a common theme in, like, being a human, too. You know, and maybe I might want to have some people I'm honest with about that stuff and then see if I can do, I don't know, some work about it. See, one of the things that came clear to me when I was doing some step work with my sponsor at one point in time, when we talked about this, you know, sex stuff as a kid, he said, because I was pretty convinced that I had done nothing wrong. And at that moment, you know what I'd done? Nothing wrong. But I was a 37, 38-year-old man still carrying that stuff. And he said, you know, they have these things out there called therapists. You could have gone and seen one. And that was like, I was like, huh, well, damn. You know, there's that. You know, there's lots. I have all these options on the table for me, but I don't engage in them because, well, it's my pain and I like it. And it's my anger and I like it. And no one is like me in the whole world. I mean, none of you have the same kind of anger I have. And you know what? You're probably right. I'm probably right with that statement. But the reality is, if I want to get better and I want to get free, I might want to engage in a solution that most of you other men have engaged in. Seems to be working for a lot of you. Maybe I'm just not that special after all. I give Bob McCullough credit for the work. All I did was liberate and expand on it. I have some people I work with that help me to narrow it in, to make it easier for addicts and alcoholics. I don't really work with people outside of that because it's not my wheelhouse. I think that at some point, if you find out why you're angry, then, you know, and you do some work around that, then maybe like having some anger management skills would be ideal. I think that if you go into it just looking to manage it, you're probably screwed. It's hard to manage something that you can't control. Any questions at this point? Fantastic. Oh, never mind.
You talked about anger being
Well, I don't know. I don't know if the silent scorn lies in the brain. I think what I talked about was that there's the reptilian, right? There's the reaction anger, and then there's the response. I'm a reaction guy. I think the silent scorn and the volatility are the same thing for me. They're the same thing. I use them in the same way. I mean, again, I'm not you, so I don't know how you use them, but either I'm going to yell and scream at you, or I'm going to scorn you. Those are the only options I really have. But they do the same thing for me. Whether I'm yelling at you or I'm murdering you, you know, 3 days from now, I'm getting the same kind of play out of that. You know, I'm better than you, and you deserve to be scorned. Yes. Yeah, it is for me.
I'm just amazed at how that was tracked. I mean, I see it, you know, all children and brothers end up not being in the topic of for extended period of time. What?
Well, it happens with me in, you know, as a 45-year-old man. You know, piss me off enough and it's likely that I'll be scorning you 6 weeks from now. You know, it's an interesting thing for me. I don't yell and scream as much as I used to because I don't want to go to jail. But what I like to do personally, what I get off at, and I think a lot of us do, is feeling like I got one over on you. You know, so I may not like out loud scorn you, but if I see you in a meeting every week, I'm scorning you every time I see you. I mean, I'm not going to necessarily hang on to it all day, every day, because I have other people I could scorn too that I see on a more regular basis. But I'm definitely not going to let go of that with you because, well, I'm right and you're wrong. And I'm justified to hate you. I mean, hell, you're wearing a Georgia hat. Isn't that a Georgia hat? Absolutely justified to hate you. You know, and that's enough for me. Generally, with normal human beings, yeah. How many people in this room are normal? There you go. What's normal? That's
setting on the Discord.
What now?
I think it's for us to hang the positive. It would have to really recognize.
How many?
With family, with kids, kids raised.
How many forms are there? How many people are in this room right now? Exactly. So, I mean, the way that I scorn is going to be different than the way that Bob scorns, or different than the way that Greg scorns. But the reality is, at the end of the day, what is that doing for me or Bob or Greg? Am I dying behind it? Am I able to get free because of it? You know, maybe Bob is. I can't. I can't get free. I mean, I have a history, and it's not like this is like some distant thing for me. This is stuff I deal with right now. If I'm going to a meeting with Bob every week and I absolutely hate him because he wears that red fleecy thing that he's got on, that's enough for me sometimes. It doesn't be a lot. And I'm hating him every time I go to the meeting. How much relief am I getting from that meeting? How much solution am I getting from that meeting? Now, how engaged am I in the moment? You know, because for most of us, that's the deal, is that I'm going to get free in the moment. If I get free in the moment, every moment, I'm free. But at that moment that I go to the meeting with Bob, that's a waste for me. And the 3 or 4 hours after, that's a waste, because what I'm going to do is mull over it. You know, if Bob would ever just stop wearing that sweater, we could be friendly together. But he's wrong and I'm right, and I'm justified to hate him. You know, and it's just something I just can't let go of. I mean, the difference for me between normal response anger and what I have is that normal people, I know this is going to come as a shock to you, Robert. Normal people get angry. Art, I hate you. Why'd you do that? They have a conversation. It's the craziest thing ever. I've seen it happen before with other people. They have a conversation and then they go away. And, exactly. And it's over. Like if you go to someone later and they're like, what was that deal with you and Art? It's not a big deal. I don't have that. I'm talking about 7 years from now, when you bring up Art's name, I'm like, man, I'm looking fucking mugwort. You know? I mean, this is instant. You know? That's crazy. There was a hand up over here.
What you said about us, and I guess us liking the way you drink, or some kind of drugs, and that really resonated with me, and I realized that recently. I feel like someone's done me wrong and excessive, and my mind will go back to that place time and time again, and I get angry by, you know, like memories of certain things that happened. Memories of certain things that happened so long ago that, you know, they're insignificant now. I mean, I had a lot of people tell me, like you said, to let go, but how do you, what does that mean? How do you,
Well, I think it's an action. I mean, I have a mind that makes all kinds of crazy decisions, but I can't necessarily do that. Currently, I'm holding on to Robert, and now I'm not. I mean, how do I let go? For me personally, I try to live in the moment. Because in the moment, I'm not angry at you. Because I'm not replaying the stuff that happened 8 years ago. And for me, and again, this might be different for you, is that what I do is this process. You know, why do I feel like it's necessary to hang on to it? That's one of the questions that you might want to ask yourself. I mean, why is it that I feel like I need to hang on to this long term? Like, what am I gaining from that? Remember the gain and loss thing? What am I gaining from that? There you go. That's part of it. I'm going to be right no matter what, Joe. No matter whether I drink, my family suffers, Lee suffers, my job suffers. It doesn't really matter to me at some point. I'm going to hang on to it. Damn it, I'm going to be right. Even though I'm dying behind it. There's a hand up over here. Hey, Greg.
They put something about resenting even though they're there. And that's where I thought anything else. And then, you know, I was supposed to deal with that anger. And we eventually learned that anger is all about fears. You know, getting, the fear of not getting something I want, the fear of losing something that I have. And I guess for me, it's been that simple. Is this a different process that you're talking about, or is this
I found that it ties in. I mean, it's just an expanded version of the process. I mean, it's almost like the way I look at it, and mind you, I'd have to talk to Bill Wilson, who clearly isn't here currently. Step 6 and 7 in the big book are like two paragraphs. And then we have the 12 and 12 that expands on that so that people actually, well, understand what the hell's going on. When I'm not talking about you, Joe. What this is for me is kind of an expansion of that stuff. Because for me, I needed to know why I got angry like I got angry and why I continued to do that. You know, 10 days sober, if you're getting angry over stuff, well, hell, welcome to not drinking. At 10 or 20 years sober, if you're getting angry on that level, that's something you may want to look at if you want to like have a life that you or other people want to be a part of.
So, does this involve my relationship with my higher power, which solves the fear problem, and then I find that it's not less angry because of that particular relationship?
The RRT does. Yeah, I think that last piece where people find whatever strategy works best for them, whether it be a certain kind of therapy or meditation or whatever they can do to kind of go inside and quiet things down, the right size piece, that seems to be super beneficial for people like myself.